Any more questions on ill will? Okay, now we move on to sloth and drowsiness. Here the Buddha says you learn how to starve sloth and drowsiness by paying appropriate attention to the potential for exertion or the potential for striving. It doesn't tell you much. But what that does, the idea that there's a potential in there, that you have some energy that you haven't tapped into. And there are various ways of tapping into it. One is to get the mind to think about something that is more interesting than the topic you're already on. Sometimes the breath gets very calming and you're out. And so try to find something that exercises the mind a little bit more. An alternative way is to, I found, try to think of which parts of the body you have not fed with breath energy for a little while. Do a kind of very, very detailed survey. How about your little toe? Has your little toe been properly breathed through? Okay. Check that one out. The spaces between your fingers, all kinds of places in the body that you tend to ignore. Okay, so search them out. One time when I was looking after my teacher, he was sick and he required, you know, attention 24 hours a day. And the other monks in the monastery very quickly discovered other duties that they had to do. And so I was taking on this monk's time period and that monk's time period, and I ended up with a 2 a.m. to 8 p.m. shift. And so you can imagine, 2:30 in the morning, I'm up and I'm kind of drowsy, and John Fung could wake up at any time, and I would need to be there. And I found that one very effective way of keeping myself awake was to focus on one spot for 3 breaths, and then another spot for 3 breaths, and another spot for 3 breaths. Just keep moving. Keep the mind moving around. And you find that there are a lot of potentials for energy in you that you have been missing. You just have to tap in to find there someplace in there. And that helps get you past the sloth and drowsiness. We have another passage that we'll be looking at in a minute, which goes more into detail on that topic. Lack of food for the arising of unarisen restlessness and anxiety, or for the growth of an increase of restlessness and anxiety once it has arisen. There's a stillness of awareness. Okay, how do you find that? You say there must be some spot in the body that's still. Some spot in my awareness that's still. This is where the image of the committee of the mind is useful. There may be something chattering away in the mind, but that's just one member of the committee. There are other members as well. And you may find, who's the observer in here? Who's watching all this? Try to get to that observer and separate yourself out. Okay, I'm watching the restlessness, but I'm not going to go along with it. Also try to breathe in whatever way it is as calming as possible. This is the opposite of the problem with the sloth and drowsiness. This time you want to calm yourself down. So even though the thoughts are racing, you can say, I will breathe slowly and deeply and gently and see just how much longer that restlessness can last. Because I'm not feeding it with the breath. A lot of these mental energies basically hijack your breath and then they just compound the problem. Like when you're angry, you will breathe in a certain way and that aggravates your anger. When you're restless, you will breathe in another way that aggravates the restlessness and anxiety. So you try to break the circuit. So okay, even though the mind will be racing around, I will breathe very, very, very calmly. And again, a lot of this has to do with seeing that the restlessness and anxiety is something that's totally irrelevant and not helpful. All too often when you are anxious about something, you can tell yourself it's really worth being anxious about. One thought that I find calming, and it's kind of a strange one, but it works, is that we're all going to die. And there'll come a point where none of this matters. Whatever I'm restless and anxious about, it's not going to matter at all. You look back and say, oh my gosh. You imagine yourself, you're off in heaven again. You look back and you say, oh my gosh, that was a lot of waste. There was a poem in Thailand that was written. When I was a layperson, I actually lived next door to a prince. When I was teaching at Chiang Mai University, this was an old prince who was given a flat there in the university. He'd been an expert on Thai literature and Thai history. And so they asked him there as a visiting scholar. Basically, originally to have him as a professor. Well, he was a lousy professor. He just would get up and just kind of talk about whatever. But he was a very good counselor for kids who were having problems with history and literature, so they kept him on. And his father was a poet, and he kept telling me that his father was the greatest poet 20th century Thailand. And I kept thinking, of course, he's your father. That's what you're going to think. And then years later, after I'd ordained, I ran across one of his poems, and it was really, really good. I said, oh, the father was much better than the son. Just as kind of an aside, the father had been to Cambridge, came back. He was expert in English, expert in Sanskrit, expert in Thai. He was the grandson of what they call the second king, which is number two to the king. So he's pretty high up in the hierarchy. And he took an interest in Thai folk poetry. Now, Thai folk poetry is extemporaneous. They'll have these poetry contests to get the women in one vote and the men in another vote. And they basically, you know, will come up with spontaneous poems, slightly insulting, sometimes very insulting, and it's supposed to be a lot of fun. One of my favorite lines is translated into English, is the man comes and says, you know, I called you the other night, you didn't answer, and she answers, I said, well, I heard the sound of people, and sound mixed with the sound of dogs, and I didn't know which one to respond to. And so this prince took an interest in this, and he noticed there was this one peasant in particular who had a very good reputation. And so he invited the peasant into his palace one time and to talk about extemporaneous poetry. And he had, in the meantime, come up with his own poem that he would chant at one of these events. And he wanted the peasant to know, wanted the peasant to give his, you know, frank opinion. And the peasant gave him a very frank opinion. He said the woman wouldn't know how to respond. It's just way too pretty, way too high language. You just don't have it. And the prince took it really well. In fact, he wrote this up in a little article one time about how he'd gotten his best criticism was from a Thai peasant. What's related here is there was one of the poems he wrote was about this deva couple. And the deva husband was always bragging about his wife. He was the prettiest deva, female deva in the heavens. And the other devas were getting sick and tired of hearing this all the time. You know, his wife was prettier than theirs. And so they say, you know, she's really all that pretty. Do you see that hermit sitting down there on earth meditating? And there was this hermit, he'd been out under the sun so long that he was just all black, and he had this part of a termite's nest to build up over his body. And the lizards were climbing up and down his body, and he wasn't responding at all. Just, if she can make him break his jhana, okay, then she's really good. So the deva husband gets his wife all dolled up in all of her deva finery. Of course, she's embarrassed about the whole thing. And so he takes her down, has her stand in front of the hermit, and then he hides behind a tree to kind of watch and see what the hermit's reaction is. And the hermit begins to realize there's something going on, so he opens his eyes and immediately takes in the whole scene. Not only the deva standing in front of him, but also her husband standing over there, hiding over there. So he curses the two of them. You two are going to have to be born as human beings and be parted three times before you get to return to heaven. Mm-hmm. That's the beginning of the story. Mm-hmm. And then the story goes on where they're born, and she's born in a wealthy family, and he's born in a very poor family. And he's walking down the street one day, and he looks up at her balcony, she looks down at him, and immediately, you know, the connection happens. So they run off, they go off in a boat, and she gets lost in a shipwreck. He finally comes ashore on this island, and there's this palace on the island. He goes in, the palace is deserted, and at the end of this one hall, there's this glass coffin. And inside is her body, and he just goes berserk until he realizes that it's a trick. It's not really her. And so he goes looking for her, finally finds her again. This happens again and again. They get separated until finally the last separation is when they're lost in the jungle, and he again sees a vision of her being devoured by a tiger. And then, so he kills himself. And she comes upon him. Because it wasn't really her being devoured, but she finds him, she sees his body, so she kills herself. Next thing you know, they're up in heaven laughing about the whole thing. So, when you start thinking, getting really anxious about things, maybe I'm just down here being cursed. And at some point I'll be able to look back on all this and laugh. So that's one way of dealing with restlessness and anxiety. As for uncertainty, he says, there are mental qualities that are skillful and unskillful, blameworthy and blameless, gross and refined, siding with darkness and with light, to foster appropriate tension to them is lack of food, the rising non-rising uncertainty. In other words, when you have doubts about things, you just look into your mind and say, okay, what in my mind right now is a skillful thought, what's an unskillful thought? Let's start dividing this up. This is how the Buddha himself said he got on the path, was looking at his thoughts and saying, instead of looking at the thought in terms of its content, he said, where would this thought lead? Would this thought lead to something good or something bad? And if it was leading to something bad, if it was imbued with sensual desire or ill will or harmfulness, you would try to put it aside. If it was not, then you would allow yourself to think it. And just being able to watch your thoughts. Now notice, this is the Buddha's cure for uncertainty. It's not just have faith in the Buddha. It's what's actually going on and seeing cause and effect in your mind. There's something you can actually watch in here. Look for that. If you say something unskillful, that's obviously unskillful, you let it go. This is why bit by bit by bit you overcome your uncertainty. And as we'll see in a minute, this is the same way of giving rise to analysis of qualities as a factor for awakening. In other words, it's by analyzing things as to whether they're skillful or not that overcomes your uncertainty and also develops your discernment as a factor that's going to lead to concentration. Do you have any questions about any of those three hindrances? Yes?
This is related to the beginning of the first mention of the five hindrances. And so both roles, for instance, and he discerns how there is the arising of unarisen sense of desire, and then how there is the abandoning of sense of desire once it is. And then discerns how there is no further appearance in the future of sensual desire, or ill will as well, that has been abandoned. And then there's another statement, speak a little bit longer on that, is it's, and then it says, it's when your lack of restraint doesn't discern, that's come to the awareness release, the discernment leaves where any evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen utterly cease without remainder. That's a little different than what we're talking about.
That's different. That's talking about arahantship. That's talking about arahantship. That's total awakening.
Ah, okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So you said, okay, you realize, and if you haven't reached there yet, you should realize that there is a state of mind where this can be happening.
Pardon me?
If you haven't reached there yet, at least you take it as one of your convictions, okay, it is possible to get beyond this.
Right, yes, so it's stated nicely and clearly there, mm-hmm. that then of course you still aren't showing very good restraint until you've reached that.
Until you reach that, because there's always going to be something lacking, but you also have to take it as, now, I guess we call it a matter of faith, okay, that okay, it is possible. I mean, there are lots of people saying, it's not possible, don't even try.
And well, it was inspiring, yes.
Yeah.
But I just thought, well, I don't recall seeing that, but I've read the sutra many times.
Yeah.
And you're right, you know, that we're learning more how to read sutras here today.
Right.
And I'm like, gee, those look interesting, what are they?
Yeah. Okay, because the discernment awareness release is basically, the ending of passion, discernment release is the ending of ignorance. So those are the two things that you've got to get past.
Well, then it mentions fetter, knowing that a fetter is gone in the same way.
Right.
That would be talking about entering the stream then, because you do shed certain fetters.
You shed certain fetters, but then there are other fetters that you still have to work on.
Yes, that
but
yeah,
you know
that.
But you know the difference. Okay, this one is shed for gone, not for good.
And you know it's done, and it isn't going to arise in the future.
Right.
Thank you.
There's a passage in the canon where this novice is meditating out in the forest, and this prince is out basically going and walking around for exercise, and he sees the novice. And he says, you know, I want to ask you a question. And the novice knows that this prince is a troublemaker. And so he says, okay, I'll answer your question, but let's not get into an argument, okay? So the prince says, sure, okay. And then the prince says, I understand that there are monks who feel no sensual desire. And the novice says, yeah. The prince says, that's impossible. And the novice says, well, you said you wouldn't. So he goes to see the Buddha. The Buddha says, you fool, you only talk to people like that. The problem problem is, I mean, we actually have some Dharma teachers nowadays who say you can't totally abandon sensuality, you can't totally abandon these things, all you have to do is just learn how to live with them. There is that strain of Dharma teaching. So you have to watch out for it.
I'm convinced you can jump the feathers.
Any other questions about the hindrances?
Usually I see doubt instead of uncertainty. Is there any significance?
They're used interchangeably. Mm-hmm. It's just that Pali has lots of different words for doubt and uncertainty. And so I figured, let's try to be consistent as possible.
Okay. And then I also have seen, not very often, restlessness and remorse.
Remorse is a bad one. Because we're talking more about the future than we are talking about the past. Mm. There's the reason they would use remorse is there's the several passages where monks may have broken a rule, but they're not really sure, and so they go see the Buddha, and they use that term, which is this particular gukwacha. But it's not so much they feel remorse over having done; they're just not really certain. They're kind of anxious when we may have broken a rule. We don't know. Yes.
About uncertainty, most of the time when we have to make decisions, so we have to have doubt, because it's difficult to make the right decision, so it takes a lot of anxiety and repeating, do I do this choice or this choice, and then you take one choice, which is maybe not the good one, so you take experience of that, but then again come the doubt of everything in life, so is it a permanent... But for me, it's a permanent anxiety about it's an hindrance, so it's...
Okay, you've got to work on this in several levels. One, the uncertainty they're talking about here is that you're uncertain about what is good and what is not good. And most of the choices we're making in life don't have to do with good and evil. It's more, which one is going to be more profitable, which one is going to be more beneficial, be less beneficial. And those things are... Of course, people are going to question those all the time. But when you've reached stream entry, your doubt about the Buddha, your doubt that there is, or the uncertainty of whether there really is or is not a path that takes all the way to the end of suffering, that's gone. You've seen, this really does lead to a dimension where there's no suffering. So from that point on, there's no doubt. Now the next morning you wake up, should I wear my blue dress or should I wear my red dress? You might have doubts about that, but that's...
So that means it's not the same level of doubt?
It's not the same level of
doubt. Doubts about if I'm on the right path?
Right.
For my...
Or if there really is a path, those kinds of things, yeah. Yes?
Would it be fair to say that the list of five hindrances is not meant to be comprehensive? And that, the important thing is that as long as we can recognize this is wholesome, this is unwholesome, and we have strategies for dealing with them, abandoning them, preventing them from arising, but that's really, that's what we need to be able to do, and not being able to place a particular unwholesome mental state in which hindrance does it belong, that's not really so important.
That's not as important as realizing, this is getting in the way of my concentration, got to do something about it. And this gives you a checklist to go through to begin with, because regardless of how you dress up the hindrances, there'll be an element of something. One of these five is going to be in there. Because basically what they come down to is desire, aversion, and then three kinds of delusion. One kind of delusion based on not enough energy, another kind of delusion based on too much energy.
Because sometimes the sort of busyness of trying to figure out which hindrance it is, that itself becomes
a hindrance. Restless and anxiety compounded, yes.
You said an antidote for drowsiness might be thinking something more interesting. Could you talk about that a little bit? It sounds dangerous to me.
Depends on what your interests are. One thing I found interesting is they had a skeleton in the meditation hall there when the monastery was ordained. I could sit there and I could look at, where in my body is that bone right now? I'm going to go down the bones. And kind of feel where that bone is, kind of a sense of where that bone is, and just kind of go down the spine, down through the different parts. Hmm. And I found that really interesting.
So back in your body,
you're still going back in your body, but you're doing it in a different way. You can download a list of 32 body parts. Ask which parts are not listed in the list. Let's kind of list those too. They don't talk about the eyes for some reason. Hmm. There are other body parts in there as well. You can go down through the 32 and then say what else is there. You got that as well. So one, as long as you're in the body, or two, they have a list of these topics you can talk about, think about. It's called recollections. So recollecting the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And recollecting your own virtue, recollecting your own generosity. Recollecting the qualities of devas, i.e. what qualities will turn somebody into a deva, and you recollect, okay, I've got some of those qualities too. Those three are designed to give you kind of uplift your energy in the practice. You can reflect on death. These are all topics that you can think about. You could die in the midst of a drowsiness attack. Wouldn't that be embarrassing?
So you're talking about using your mind to pull you out of that stupor.
The stupor, right. Yeah.
Okay. Whatever you do, just...
get out. Yeah.
And you can use your breath and energy flow, or you can use your mind.
Whatever you find that's a Dharma topic that's interesting, it's fine. Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how do you recollect your own virtue, for instance, without tipping over the line into becoming arrogant and self-righteous?
Okay, that's meant to be used when you're really feeling down on yourself and you need an antidote, because otherwise you're getting really discouraged in the practice. And the Buddha says if you take pride in your fact and then realize, okay, there's still more to be done, that helps to, because you're not trying to compare yourself with other people. I mean, the real problem is the comparing. You know, my virtue is better than yours. Yeah. Well, who cares about other people? You gotta say this. It's like you've got a disease and you're taking your medicine, and your neighbor in the hospital has a disease and she's not taking her medicine. Now, are you gonna sit there and be proud of that? I'm taking my medicine and she's not taking hers.
You might.
About 5 minutes of that, you get kind of embarrassed. But you've got to have the attitude, look, I'm taking care of my own problems here. And whether other people are taking care of theirs or not is not really the issue. So I've got these problems in here I've got to take care of. At least I'm getting somewhere in the practice. Because you do need that. Conceit is one of the last fetters to go. And all of the Buddha warned you very early on, don't base your conceit on comparing with other people. But that's one of the dangers that he always keeps saying. No matter how good you are in the practice, don't exalt yourself over other people, because then you lose it. But you do have to exalt yourself over what you used to be. So I used to be, you know, whatever. And then it's useful practice. Now the thing about recollecting your virtue and your generosity, if you did one virtuous act 15 years ago, and you keep going over and over and over that one act, and holding the image of a dog chewing on a bone, you know? In other words, keep on being virtuous, keep on being virtuous. So you have fresh virtue and fresh generosity to think about.
Okay, so I'm still processing what I'm asking here. So it seems like for me, most of my preoccupation is with my body, not in terms of my beauty or anything, but just physical sensations. And, you know, I'm not doing this very much, hardly ever anymore. It's mostly just it's discomfort you know, too much energy or not enough energy or deadness or, you know, too much, too hot. You know, I mean, there's just a lot of physical things. And so I'm, you know, that's why I'm doing a lot of body work right now, because it's getting rid of some of those physical stresses. But I guess it's an open question. It's just like that's where I'm at. And I don't know if that's a form of stupor because I'm like stuck in my body and I, you know, I mean, I feel pretty clear mentally, but my body can drag me into a stupor.
Okay, that's what you got to watch out for, is this the obsession with this.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you do what you can.
Mm-hmm.
There comes a point where you say, I'm putting an awful lot of energy into the body. What about my mind? Because the mind is the thing you're going to be taking with you.
Mm-hmm.
What's the state of the mind? I don't want to be overly obsessed with these issues of the body. Work with the breath as best you can and say, okay, this is good enough to settle down.
Okay. So, what happens is if I'm too much into my body, I get asthma.
Mm-hmm.
So then if I can't breathe, I can't, you know, I can't go into a jhana. I can't. I'm tight and I'm stressed and I'm small. I'm not, you know, and I can go beyond that, but it takes, you know, it takes some focus on
it. Yeah. Well, that, just take that as a challenge. And also think about all the different parts of the body that the breath energy can come in and out besides.
Just keep. Okay.
Think of whole body and your skin pores are open. When I had malaria, I found that, you know, with the, basically you're being starved of oxygen because those little malaria parasites are eating up all your red blood cells. And so the muscles that are doing most of the work for the breathing tend to get very tired.
Yeah.
And it's just really hard to breathe. And as one night I was struggling with that, and I said, wait a minute. There are other muscles in my body. Why can't they sort of pitch in and do the work?
Mm-hmm.
And I started visualizing other parts of the body, like the, you know, the breath can come in the top of the head, breath can come in the back, all the spots that John mentioned.
Okay.
And I think of the breath coming in the middle of the forehead, to your cheeks, to your sinuses, whatever.
Okay.
And that took a lot of the load off of the muscles that had been overworked.
Okay. Yeah. So just keep scanning.
Yeah. And hold another picture. This is metal fabrication.
Yeah.
Hold that picture in mind.
Okay.
Yes.
Question. So are the hindrances just hindrances to concentration, or can we think of them as hindrances to right thought? Or
yeah, right action? They're hindrances to right view, right resolve, something. There's a very close connection between right resolve and right concentration. You have to make up your mind, I'm going to focus on something that gets out of sensuality and out of ill will. And these things are saying, no, we want to think about this first and that first. And you have to recognize that this is a wrong thought. Okay, this one passage is specifically for drowsiness, or about drowsiness, but not for drowsiness. Mogalan is sitting there, nodding. I love these stories where the monks are sitting there and their meditation is going lousy and the Buddha suddenly appears in front of them. Whoops! He said, Mogalana, are you nodding? Yes, Laura, I'm nodding. Okay, then he gives 7 ways of dealing with drowsiness. First thing is, whatever perception you had in mind when drowsiness descended on you, don't attend to that perception, don't pursue it. In other words, you change the topic of your meditation. If you're working with the breath, this can either mean change the way you breathe, change the way you, the perception you hold in mind of the breath, or go to another topic that exercises your mind more. If that doesn't shake off your drowsiness, then recall to your awareness the Dhamma as you've heard and memorized it, re-examine it and ponder it over in your mind. Okay, just think about, okay, what did we learn this last weekend in the Dharma? The Dharma Hall? Okay, try to call that to mind. Just bring it up. They used to memorize, and this is one of the reasons why the Buddha had the monks memorize the Dharma, and lay people were also told to memorize the Dharma as much as they could. So you have something to draw on. This is one of the reasons why we chant, is to get these things kind of drummed into your mind. Because you think about all the kind of garbage that has been drummed into our mind by the media. And it's good to have something to counteract it. One of the monks at the monastery, he was in Mexico one time when he was learning a sort of Spanish immersion class. And at one point they had a party and they got together with Mexican students, started singing Mexican folk songs, and then turned to the Americans, can you sing us some American folk songs? the American students kind of looked at each other and what folk songs did they know? So they sang Gilligan's Island. So you've got Gilligan's Island and the Lurgus, what else going on in your brain right now? So it's good to start memorizing some useful things about Dharma lists. By the way, I neglected to mention at the beginning, this list of the five Dharma topics that we're going on here, this plus the list of Dharmas in the Wings to Awakening, that is the basic Dharma curriculum in almost every monastic school in Asia. If you're going to learn basic Dharma, these are the five topics plus the seven senses and the Wings to Awakening. That's kind of basic, kind of essential Dharma for them. So if you read a painting and your mind doesn't shake off your drowsiness, then you repeat it aloud. In other words, you start chanting. I love this next one. If chanting doesn't do it, then pull both of your earlobes and rub your limbs with your hands. Get your circulation going. That doesn't, then get up from your seat and after washing your eyes out with water, look around in all directions and upward to the major stars and constellations. Of course, up in Bellingham, you don't have much opportunity to look at the major stars and constellations. Look at the lights on Grouse Mountain. If by doing this you don't shake off your drowsiness, then attend to the perception of light. In other words, visualize light filling your body. And if by this you don't shake off your drowsiness, then percipient of what lies in front and behind, set a distance to meditate walking back and forth. Your senses inwardly immersed, your mind not straying outwards. In other words, get up and do walking meditation. Now sometimes you hear people talking about, go sit on the edge of a cliff, that'll wake you up. And I tried that one time and I almost fell asleep, so I would not recommend that. Okay, if none of these things work, and what this all is meant to do is to activate the perception that, okay, maybe just because I'm feeling drowsy doesn't mean I really need to sleep. Maybe it's just the mind playing a trick on itself. Let's test it. But if after testing in all these ways it doesn't work, then reclining on your right side, take up the lion's posture, one foot placed on top of the other, mindful alert with your mind set on getting up. As soon as you wake up, get up quickly with thought, I won't stay indulging the pleasure of lying down. So you test the drowsiness first, and then you realize, okay, the body really does need to rest after you've tested it. Then you lie down. But you make up your mind, I'm not going to just lie there when I wake up. If I wake up, I'll get up. Continue meditating. That way you keep yourself awake. Any questions on that? Yes, John?
A couple. One, why the lion's posture?
That was the recommended way of sleeping.
And for what reason?
I think it's because when you're lying that way, your blood is actually above your head, your heart is above your head. So,
what is the lion's posture?
When you're lying on your right side.
Oh.
Do lions do that?
Apparently. Well, they're trying to make it sound noble and honorable, right? See, if you lie on your back, that's the corpse posture. If you lie on your stomach, that's an animal posture. Apparently, if you lie on your left side, that's the side that people who, according to the monks' tradition, if you lie on your left side, that's the side that people who are indulging in sensuality lie on. Now, I don't know anything about that. Although John Lee makes the point, they said, look, when you're lying on your right side a long time, it hurts, so you switch. Mm-hmm.
I think it's really less the pressure on the heart to lay on the right side. Is there a health benefit to it? And also, if you talk about insomnia, like using lying meditation to overcome insomnia.
I really don't know if it would overcome insomnia. Hmm. No, you're less likely to snore when you're lying on your side than when on your back. Mm-hmm. Yes?
So the other thing was, your senses inwardly immersed, your mind not straying outwards. Is that essentially exercising sense restraint?
Yeah, and basically you're walking and you're not gazing around. There's a nice passage in the John Mun biography where he's been doing walking meditation in the jungle, and he gets this vision, and Deva comes to him and says, look, when you're doing walking meditation, you've got to keep your eyes down. You're not out here to do sightseeing. Okay, let's move on to the factors for awakening. Now, these are the exact opposite of the hindrances. In fact, they're usually taught as pairs. The hindrances are the unskillful set, and the factors for awakening are the skillful set that counteracts them. Okay, the first one is mindfulness. Okay, there are qualities that act as a foothold for mindfulness, and according to, as I said, one passage says that your virtue is well purified and your views are made straight. Well purified virtue as a requisite for mindfulness is important, because if your virtue isn't good, as soon as you start meditating, you start remembering things that you did that were unskillful, and you try to block them out. Now, blocking things out is not good for mindfulness. It becomes a habit. You block out this, you start blocking out that, blocking out other things, and pretty soon you're can't remember anything. So if you look back on your behavior and you don't see anything to criticize, then it's a lot easier to develop your memory, keep it solid, keep it strong. To foster appropriate attention to them, this is the food for the arising of unarisen mindfulness. So you focus, work on getting your views straight, getting your virtues straight, that strengthens your mindfulness. Now, the analysis of qualities is a factor for awakening. Notice here, there are qualities that are skillful and unskillful, blameworthy and blameless, gross and refined, citing the darkness and the light. Okay, this way of feeding your analysis of qualities is the same thing as starving your uncertainty. You develop your discernment by looking, okay, what in my mind is actually skillful and what's not. And again, the way to look at it, whether it's skillful, is you ask one, where is it coming from? Two, where is it going? You're looking at it as part of a process. How to give rise to unarisen persistence. Here again, the potential for effort, the potential for exertion. Okay, this is the opposite of sloth and torpor, sloth and drowsiness. Working on basically what this is talking about is right effort. And when, rather than wait till tomorrow to talk about right effort, we talk about it right now. Right effort is not just putting forth energy, it's also learning how to motivate yourself. Part of it is called the formula is that you generate desire and you uphold your intent. In other words, you give rise to the desire to do what's skillful and to drop what's unskillful, and then you try to maintain that intent as you focus on it. And there are lots of different ways of giving rise to that motivation. Compassion is one of them. Compassion for yourself, compassion for others, that by following this path you are harmless. You're actually helping yourself and you're actually helping other people. Heedfulness is the major one, that you realize, okay, my actions really do make a difference. And if I allow myself to indulge in unskillful activity, that's going to be a problem down the line. Again, I'll be harming myself and harming others. I've got to get my act together. The Buddha said that all skillful qualities are rooted in heedfulness. It's an interesting statement. Sometimes you hear that all you have to do is just open up to your innate goodness and there you are. And the Buddha says, well, you have some innate other qualities too. Mm-hmm. And how are you going to choose? You say, okay, if I act on this quality, where is it going to lead? What's it going to take me? In terms of psychology, this is called anticipation. It's a healthy ego function. Anticipate what's going to happen. You anticipate dangers and you do what you can to prevent them. Another motivation we talked about earlier this morning was shame. I would be ashamed. Here I have the opportunity to practice and I'm not taking advantage of it. I'd be ashamed to let this opportunity go. Pride is another one. That here I am, I've gotten this far as a meditator. Can I let myself drop? I've got to maintain my, you know, just sort of the honor of my, of being a meditator. It's a word we don't talk about much, honor, anymore. Years back, I was giving a Dharma talk, and they happened to mention the word dignity. And after the talk was over, there was a woman, she was a Russian immigrant. And she came up to me and she said, I've been here in the States for 12 years now, and this is the first time I've heard an American say dignity. I just chill went over me. Nobody talks about it anymore, which means if you're not even talking about it, nobody's thinking about it. Did you see that cartoon in the New Yorker just the other week? This old man is talking to his grandson. He says, grandson, as you go through life, don't forget to monetize the roses.
Yeah.
Take time to stop and monetize the roses. There's no dignity in monetizing. So those are some of the ways you motivate yourself to practice. Get yourself out of your torpor. Remember that line from Tom Jones? Squire Western and his wife and his sister. And his sister says, calls his name, get out of your bucolic torpor. She had a sharp tongue. Okay. So once you start giving rise to persistence, the Buddha says that the natural thing that follows, if you're doing it properly, and again, we're not just talking about just any old effort, we're talking about skillful effort. When you work skillfully, you give rise to an energy that is refreshing in the body. This is one of the ways you can test, is my effort right effort or is it wrong effort? Is it just wearing me out? This is not right effort. Because right effort involves not only the proper motivation, but also knowing exactly what should be done in terms of the different tasks that face you. You know, is this something we're facing? Is this something to be abandoned? Or is this something to be developed? Or something to just be watched? And another, the next one, of course, is what amount of effort is skillful? How much is too much? How much is too little? And those two things are determined, one, by how much energy you have. And secondly, what's appropriate for that particular problem. Some problems require that you be very, very precise and very delicate. You just can't just use a lot of energy to bang through. Other times you've got to use a lot of energy. So just right means appropriate for that particular topic. As for your own level of energy, you know the story about Sona, the monk who was meditating until he was walking meditation until his feet were bleeding. He was getting discouraged. And the Buddha again appeared to him and said, when you were a lay person, did you play the lute? He said, yes. He said, when the strings were too tight, did it sound good? No. When the strings were too loose, did it sound good? No. And he said, okay, just tune the strings so they're just right. And it's just right. He says, you start out, and then he makes a comparison of the five strengths. You tune your level of energy so it's just right. And then to that, you tune your conviction, your mindfulness, your concentration, discernment. In other words, you try to develop these qualities as they are appropriate for your level and your state of mind at that moment. You're coming home from work, you're tired. It's not the time to say, I will sit down and I will not get up until I've received and achieved an excelled awakening. That's a little bit too much conviction. You say, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to make it through the hour.
Does Buddha ever still appear to people that you know of?
Well, I mean, the stories about Ajahn Mun, the visions of the Buddha. And even he, though, would never say, well, is this really the Buddha, or is this just something in my mind? And this is one of the reasons why, there's that old Zen saying, if you see the Buddha, kill the Buddha. Because you don't know who's messing with your mind or how your mind is messing with you. And Ajahn Mun, you think about it, he had all those visions when he was in the forest. And if he didn't have some way of checking the visions, he'd have gone crazy. Because you can't believe everything that comes in. And sometimes the same when your mind is still, you can believe whatever, you can trust whatever comes in to your still mind. You can't. Because who knows what kind of defilements are coming up. So whatever comes up, whatever, no matter who seems to be coming and telling you this in the vision, you have to say, does this sound right in terms of the Dharma that I know? And if it's obviously wrong, you drop it. If you're not 100% sure, okay, let's give it a try. And then look at the results. because you know, I do know cases of some of my friends, you know, that seen Davis come and talk to them. But then again, some of the Davis are pretty dumb. Just because you're David doesn't mean you know anything. You just did a lot of good things. You know. We know those kind of people. They're generous and they're virtuous, but they don't know very much. They can become Davis. Yeah. And then they come down, they're going to tell you what they know. So you can't trust all that. So when your effort is right, then it gives rise to a sense of rapture and refreshment. The explanation here is pretty unhelpful. There are qualities that act as a foothold for rapture. Okay, thank you. The foothold for rapture is direct thought evaluation. You work with your mental fabrications in a way that's skillful. In other words, the question is, where is there a sense of ease in the body? How do I maintain that? And then how do I allow that to spread? That's what gives rise to rapture. So it's one way I find that is really helpful is you sit and you relax your hands as much as you can, both front and back. And then you notice, what is the quality of sensation that I feel in those hands when they're totally relaxed like that? And then see if I can I allow that quality to move up my arms? And then move up to the arms. And then try the same thing with your feet. Totally relax every muscle in your foot. If you can't do both feet at once, try one foot first and then the other foot. And then it's okay, that quality of just blood is flowing nicely, everything is very full. Okay, allow that to spread up the legs. And see if you can get it all the way up the body. That's your homework assignment for tonight. Calm is a factor for awakening. Again, there is physical calm and there is mental calm. To foster appropriate attention, again, you notice where is there a calm sensation in my body? Where is there a calm spot in my mind? Focus in on that. The rising of unarisen concentration. Basically, you focus in on the four establishings of mindfulness. Ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with the reference to the world. And then finally, equanimity. And equanimity is fostered by the way you think about things. One is you realize the principle of karma. There are certain things that because of the other person's actions or your past actions, you just can't do anything about it. You learn how to accept that. Secondly, you think about the fact, okay, if I allowed myself to get worked up about things that I can't change, I'm going to get useless to do things I can change. So it helps you develop thoughts of equanimity. Feelings of equanimity. And then you work on your concentration. Those are the things that will strengthen your equanimity. Now, as the Buddha says in another passage, there are times when you need to foster the more active factors for awakening, such as analysis of qualities, rapture, persistence. When your mind is feeling sluggish, that's when you want to work things up. Again, by analyzing things, trying to give rise to a sense of energy that comes from that. There are other times when your mind is worked up, you're restless, anxious, whatever. This is when you start thinking of serenity, calm, concentration, and equanimity. So these are antidotes for the unskillful extremes of energy. Questions on any of those?
I had a question about rapture. So the way you've described it is that it's mostly a physical Is there mental rupture as well?
Yeah, you can really get into the physical side and go with it.
Okay. So, yeah. I get those the feelings of, the ones that you've described before of the physical rupture, but then I can sometimes these days cultivate a real feeling of, that's not my usual way of being, of a kind of, a kind of amusement or something that's a huge relief to me. Is that?
Yes.
Is that rapturous?
Yeah, that would be rapturous, yeah.
Okay.
And try to notice when you do that, what's the physical sensation?
Okay.
Or set of physical sensations that go along with that. Because you can work on it from either from the physical side or from the mental side.
The physical and this, what I consider physical rapture and this bemused state seem totally different to me. Is that so? But
okay, well then when you have that bemused state, ask yourself, how does it feel physically?
Okay.
Can you relate it to, is there any similarity? Because rapture manifests itself in many different ways.
Okay.
It's not just one.
All right.
Sometimes it's very overwhelming, sometimes it's just fullness, sometimes there's a tingling. I've heard some people, really extreme cases, they start saying just kind of things come out of them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I know this one woman, one time she would sit and meditate and she'd start rocking back and forth a lot. And she came out of meditation and said, see that? That was my rapture. I said, okay, I buy the fact that it's a rapture, but why are you telling us about this?
You were saying with the seven factors, some are energizing and some are calming. Where would mindfulness fit in?
Mindfulness is right in the middle.
Okay, sort of like in the middle of the teeter-totter.
Yeah, and it's also the one that sort of keeps watch over things. It's okay, this is the situation I'm in right now. This is what I got to do. It's kind of like the governing principle that watches out. Okay, what do I need now? Do I need to bring in the energy or bring in the calming?
So it's kind of a discerning.
There's a discernment that comes with it, yeah. Remember, it's holding these things in mind. That this is an issue I've got to watch out for in my meditation. When the energy is down, I've got to lift it. When the energy is too high, I've got to bring it down. So this is, and the Buddha says, that's the quality that's appropriate everywhere. Satisfied? I was looking through my notes of the talk I was going to give this morning. There's one point that I neglected to talk about, which I think is an important one. I'll just mention it right now. What the Buddha's having you do here, we talked about how we're working on a problem that you feel very inwardly. His solution is also an inward solution, that you're going to solve this problem from the inside going out. Now, he's making a very important statement here. You think about what the materialistic science tells us, which is that consciousness is just what they call an epiphenomenon of physical processes. That the real thing that's actually going on is a physical process. And what you're sensing is just kind of a byproduct. And I mean, that's a very deterministic view. The Buddha is saying no. That what you're doing from within your consciousness, that's actually what's going on to shape your experience. He's also denying the sort of the postmodern statement, which is you are nothing but social forces acting on you, and to be unhappy you would have to change the society. He's saying, no, you've got to change the way you're fabricating your experience right now from within. So it's a very strong message about the power of your awareness to take a problem that you feel and that you can work through it from the inside. This is all of what this is all about. You're reshaping your experience from the inside. Now part of this, of course, means you hear the words of the Buddha coming in from the outside, you've got to figure out, okay, where does this correspond to what I'm feeling inside? So it takes a while to kind of get a sense of, like when a John Jeff is telling you about breath energy, and you say, there is no breath energy in my body. There is. I'm just going to learn how to give it some space. When you can relate to it, then you can start using it as your own. Because in every case, you have to make these teachings your own before you can get the best benefit out of them. So it's not so much you're imposing an outside structure on it, it's that he's handing you tools. And as you get used to these tools, they go, I can use these for the purposes I want, which is to end the suffering that I'm causing myself. So that's the parting thought for the day. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow morning.